Hello and welcome. This is Nancy reading with you from the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. Today is Wednesday, March 1st, 2017. We'll just dive right into our front page headline. The main headline has to do with the Urbana mayoral primary, and the headline is Regime Changing, Marland Wins Democratic Nomination. An 8-year Urbana City Councilwoman who campaigned on the promise of improving economic development in Urbana is one step closer to becoming mayor. Diane Marlin took the Democratic mayoral nomination by a landslide in Tuesday's primary, piling up 2,427 votes to 12-year incumbent Laurel Prussing's 1,510 and Evelyn Underwood's 316. Next up, an April 4th date with Republican Rex Bradfield in the consolidated general election. "I'm surprised by the margin," Prussing said. "I thought it would be close. But Marlin ran a good campaign and started early, so she did a good job." With all 23 precincts reporting, the victory was called for the alderwoman about 8:20 p.m. Tuesday. Arriving at the Brookins Administrative Center shortly after her victory was official, Marlin said she was grateful and excited about the road ahead. "I'm looking forward to the next month of campaigning and plan to continue to meet with voters and discuss issues," she said. The three main topics she plans to campaign on: bringing professional administration back to the city of Urbana, putting together a plan for economic development so Urbana can thrive, and negotiating a fair labor contract with city employees. "I really want to see us grow and thrive," Marlin said. "I wanted to develop a more resilient economy. It will be a long-term process. It won't happen overnight. Urbana has so much potential, and we need to start to live up to that potential. The greatest resource in our community is the people here, their knowledge and passion and talent. I want to utilize that and work together to make our community better and make sure we meet the needs of the people in the community," she said. Free at last. Marlin said her campaign team is gearing up and ready to go this next month as she works to defeat Bradfield, who lost mayoral races against Prussing in 2009 and 2013. Prussing's prediction this time around: "Marlin will win, no doubt about it," she said. The two women go back a ways to 2009 when Prussing said she encouraged Marlin to run for a seat on the city council. Prussing even thought Marlin might one day unseat her, she admitted Tuesday night. Upon arriving at Brookins, where unofficial tallying showed that about 15.8% of registered Urbana voters cast ballots, Marlin shook hands with both of her primary opponents. "It takes courage to run for office," she said, adding she has learned a lot from Prussing. Prussing has no future plans to run for public office, but said she wants to stay a part of the coalitions she started as mayor. Before leaving at the end of April, she said she wants to tie up loose ends with the state Supreme Court case against Carroll Foundation Hospital. A decision is expected in the coming weeks. And establish a plan for renovating the former Landmark Hotel downtown. "This will give me some time to work in my garden and do some more relaxing things," Prussing said. "I enjoyed being mayor, but it was kind of a huge job." Asked on WDWS AM 1400 what else went through her mind as the news sunk in, Prussing paused before responding, "Free at last," she said with a laugh, "free at last." Bradfield, listen. Bradfield spent Tuesday night following the results from home. After wishing all three Democratic contenders well and offering congratulations on a nice, honest campaign, the Republican engineer issued a plea to voters in his Democrat-dominated home city. "I ask that the general public listen to the answers and decide which way they want the city to go in," he said, by phone, just after 9 p.m. "Please don't make this just a division of political beliefs." He said voters should expect to hear a lot about economic development over the next month, a topic he said he has preached about for the last 8 years. He and Marlin have something in common there. In candidate forums leading up to the election, she vowed to help build relationships between local investors and developers, and said she wants to make it easier for businesses to move into Urbana. Among other issues on her platform, she's on record as saying she plans to maintain Urbana's status as sanctuary city for undocumented immigrants. She has said she would like to see crime in the Sunnycrest Center part of town decrease before encouraging more businesses in that area. She's in favor of making downtown Urbana more family-friendly and has said she'd like to see the city come up with a new plan for the Sweet Corn Festival, one in which the city doesn't end up losing money. And she is in favor of lowering property taxes and marketing the city in a way that attracts more families. One of Prossing's favorite memories from her times as mayor was creating a better working relationship with city council than mayors of the decades past. "I think Marlin will continue that," Prossing said. And in accompanying sidebar, what it means. If she defeats Republican Rex Bradfield next month, one of the first things Diane Marlin has said she'd do is to hire a professional city administrator, something the city hasn't had for most of Mayor Laurel Prossing's tenure. Prossing said she felt competent enough to handle that role herself. The big redevelopment plan for the 95-year-old hotel building in downtown Urbana, most recently known as the Urbana Landmark Hotel, is on very thin ice. Marlin called the redevelopment scheme, which hasn't been made public yet, a huge risk for taxpayers. She favors building a new, environmentally friendly hotel and convention center on the site. The war of words between Carl and the city will fade away. Marlin says she believes hospitals should pay property taxes and shouldn't get a tax exemption for providing charity care. But she's also said she wants to have a more productive working arrangement with the big health care provider in the north side of the city. And here are five more races to watch. The elected leaders of Champaign and Danville are off the ballot until 2019, but virtually every other area town's mayor or village president job will be up for vote 34 days from today. Among those we'll be paying close attention to: Georgetown. Darren Riedenauer has been mayor since Kay Sanders' 2015 death. He'll run to keep the job against former Mayor Dennis Lucas and Councilman Carl Johnson and Darren Alexander. Gibson City. In his quest for a fourth term, Dan Dickey will face his first challenger since 2005, Ward 3 Alderman John Carlson, for the $8,000 a year job. Monticello. In the running for the job, Chris Corey gave up in 2015, citing struggles with chronic Lyme disease, incumbent Larry Stoner, and Alderman Joe Brown and Seth Melton. Rantoul. The three-man race features the current mayor, Chuck Smith, since 2013, the former mayor, Neil Williams, from 2001 to 2013, and a village trustee, Gary Wilson. In Savoy, with Robert McCleary stepping aside, two village trustees will go head-to-head: Joan Dykstra, seeking to become Savoy's first woman president, and John Brown. Also on the front page, news from the State Farm Center. We have the headline, "Country Superstar Brooks to Return." 20 years after playing three sold-out shows in 3 months here, Garth Brooks is returning to State Farm Center. Sources familiar with the situation told WDWS 1400 AM Tuesday night that the country music superstar will again play multiple shows in the building during the last weekend in April. An official announcement on the worst-kept local concert secret could come as soon as today. Social media has been abuzz with rumblings about Brooks' return since last May, when it was announced that Ebert Fest and the Christie Clinic Illinois Marathon would share April's third weekend to clear the calendar for a major event on the final weekend of the month. And finally, on page one, under Agricultural Outlook, we have the headline, "Forecast Calls for Higher Corn Prices." Corn prices could see a slight increase this year, while soybeans could see a slight decrease. And as always, weather will play a big role. That's the early forecast from University of Illinois ag economist Darrell L. Good who spoke to about 40 people Tuesday at the annual Dewey Bank Farmers Breakfast. Overall, he said, not a lot has changed since last year. Corn prices could increase by about 20 cents to about $3.60 or $3.70 a bushel. Good expects this because corn acreage should go down, given past years of low corn prices. Prices could also benefit from an improved domestic economy. But not everything is expected to go corn's way in 2017. Production in Brazil was down last year and is expected to recover this year, which will compete directly with U.S. corn. China is also cutting back on ethanol imports and building an inventory of domestic corn. Corn prices have been low the past 3 years as farmers have above average yields. If those yields dip below the trendline average, Good said corn prices could reach $4. With soybeans, Good said, we're going to average nationally probably $9.50 beans this year. I'd look for that to be 50 to 60 cents lower for the 2017-2018 crop. Soybean prices have stayed relatively high, despite large yields the past 3 years, thanks in large part to strong and growing demand from China. While this is expected to plateau, it's not expected to shrink. Biodiesel is also still growing, though there is uncertainty about how much the Trump administration wants it. This year, soybean prices could be hurt by a couple factors. With corn acreage expected to decline, soybean acreage could increase, which would hurt prices. South America is also expected to recover from a weak year due to widespread flooding. With all of his predictions, Good cautioned that much will depend on the weather. The wild card, as is always the case this time of the year, what kind of weather are we going to have here in the U.S. in 2017, he said. Harlan Trotter, 82, farms outside of Dewey, and said he has been able to hold steady during the past few years of low corn prices. It's been bearable, he said, after Good's presentation. He trusts Good's forecasts, but agreed the weather is always unpredictable. That old boy's usually right on the money, he said. It's very hard to predict the future in this game. A lot of things can change, mainly the weather, and he mentioned that. So, yeah, I think we'll be all right. We'll move on to news in the local section now. We have news from the University of Illinois. The headline is Many Happy Returns. 50th birthday turns U of I's 150th birthday turns U of I's sights toward 21st century challenges. Nearly 1 million people have received diplomas from the University of Illinois since its founding in 1867. The U of I and other land-grant institutions were created with a sense of optimism and a mission to educate the masses, creating one of the most powerful and enlightened countries in the world, as Board of Trustees President Tim Koritz put it. Now it's time to define that mission for the next 150 years and tackle the daunting challenges of the 21st century, U of I leaders said Tuesday at the kickoff celebration for the school's sesquicentennial celebration. That is not going to be easy, but it is essential, Chancellor Robert Jones said in his keynote address. Other speakers celebrated the U of I's accomplishments, but also acknowledged past discrimination and challenged the school to broaden its focus. American higher education finds itself in an unsettling place today, Jones said. Demand for its groundbreaking discoveries and innovation continues to grow, while traditional sources of financial support are on the downward trend, he said. There is a disagreement about the value of education and where it should rank in a list of public investment priorities. We find ourselves in debates about whether higher education is a fundamental right for all or just a privilege for some, he said. Administrators wrestle with how to increase access to broader populations and attract top faculty, he said. Despite that daunting list, Jones and others said they remain optimistic about the U of I's future. We've been faced with a list like this before, Jones said. Erosion of trust. The U of I's founders faced struggles with budgets, hiring faculty, and who should be allowed to attend, he said. It has managed to grow from a single building with 77 students to one of the world's most respected universities with 44,000 students and sister campuses that span the state. There was no blueprint or instructional guide, he said, but an idea that was applied to the context of the times and changed to meet the needs of each generation. As a public institution today, the U of I must engage with the public, Jones said, not just through traditional service programs, but as an organizing principle. One of its greatest strengths is to organize people around critical issues, he said. We can bring about partnerships and networks that do not come together naturally. Jones said there has been an erosion of public trust in the connection of our work to the issues that most concern people, such as hunger, poverty, energy security, political deadlock, discrimination, and economic disparity. People are losing hope that those problems can be solved and don't see universities as a solution, he said. He said universities need to do a better job of explaining the value of contributions that come from programs whose discoveries don't end up on the manufacturing line, but still end up changing the world. The pursuit of pure knowledge and discovery is the foundation of a world-class research university, he said. Those remarks drew applause, as did his call for the U of I to take on controversial issues, and his endorsement of academic freedom as a bedrock principle of the university. He outlined the history of innovation at the U of I from people who refused to accept the status quo, among them disability pioneer Tim Nugent, who reshaped access and architectural design, historian James Randall, whose analysis of Lincoln and the causes of the Civil War gave us insight that I believe current leaders would find instructive in today's political climate, and physicist Nick Holoniak, whose discovery of the red LED changed the way we see everything. Eye for inclusivity. He said the U of I also has to find ways to offer affordable opportunities to all students. Our land-grant promise is that our doors will be open to those with the desire to learn and the willingness to work hard, he said. We need to ensure that no family finds those doors closed because they cannot write a large enough check. Others recalled how black students weren't allowed to live on campus in the 1940s and 50s, including current trustee James Montgomery. I must raise my voice to challenge this great institution to renew a land-grant initiative and increase recruitment of African-American students and staff, State Representative Carol Ammon said, drawing applause. Democracy can't work without educated communities, Ammon said, before concluding with the ILLINI chant. In his opening remarks, MC and journalism professor Chris Benson recounted the U of I narrative, illustrated by the university's I symbol, half a Corinthian column, representing classical ideas of enlightened public discourse and free speech, and the other half a modern I, symbolizing a more expansive view of our work. The I represents innovation, inspiration, and instruction, as well as inclusivity, he said. He called for a university that is interconnected, not just in terms of collaborative research, but in attacking tough social issues and the deeper sense of what it means to be a good citizen. I doesn't stand alone, he said, referring to the U of I's name. When you and I stand together, there is nothing we can't accomplish and no story that will be better told. Shaped my life. The U of I has faced tough times in the past, but it's filled with people who are dedicated to its future, said Koritz, the third generation of his family to attend the U of I. He also earned a medical degree at Harvard and studied at Cambridge. The University of Illinois literally opened the doors of the world to me and shaped my life. The event featured stirring renditions of U of I anthems and historical songs such as Shenandoah by the U of I chamber music singers, Deep River by soprano Ollie Watts Davis, and Brother, Can You Spare a Dime by baritone Nathan Gunn. Both singers earned standing ovations. Deputy Governor Leslie Munger brought a proclamation from Governor Bruce Rauner naming Tuesday University of Illinois Day. A joint resolution from Champaign-Urbana's mayors proclaimed February 28, 2017 through May 13, 2018 as the sesquicentennial year of the U of I. Hours before losing in Tuesday night's primary, Urbana Mayor Laurel Prussing noted that her city had fought hard to bring the U of I here. "It's one of the best things we ever did," she said. Also in the local section, program targets drug-using youth. "Teens, if you commit to this program, it's going to be 9 hours a week of your after-school time. You'll have to put down your cell phones for a while and talk to other teens in the room, but they've got issues a lot like yours. And if you really want it, it's a chance to take back your life." This is Rose Krantz's pitch for a new intensive outpatient therapy program for adolescents and school-age teens with substance abuse problems. It's just getting started with 3 kids signed up so far. More are welcome. Assessments are free, so parents on the fence about whether their kids have a serious enough problem to need this kind of help are encouraged to call and ask questions, said Sheila Ferguson, Executive Director of Rose Krantz Champaign-Urbana. This program is therapist-led, peer group, after-school therapy intended for teens with drug and alcohol problems serious enough to need help, but not yet so out of hand to require being sent away to an inpatient treatment center. Some of the teens who may end up in this program are marijuana users. Some have problems with alcohol. Some have graduated from pot to opioids, like prescription pain medications. Many are already having issues at home, school, or with the law. The program meets 3 days a week from 4 to 7 p.m. and includes at least once a week drug testing. The first hour is spent talking about any relapses or family, school, or social issues that have been going on, said David Welch, Rose Krantz clinical coordinator. The next 2 hours are devoted to learning about such things as getting and staying sober, dealing with life issues, and the effects of drugs on the body. For example, many teens view marijuana as harmless and then are unprepared to deal with its lingering effects, Welch said. If you've been using and smoking marijuana a long time, a lot of people don't realize it takes your body a long time to get rid of that, he said. Families are encouraged to be involved in this program, Welch said, and while teens remain in their own homes, they're strongly encouraged to establish new social habits and break the old ones, keeping them in substance abuse patterns, Welch said. It's really about teaching them to learn to live their life while they're living it, he said. This kind of group therapy, which draws on the power of feedback from peers, is considered the most effective way to treat substance use issues for this age group, Welch said. It's going to have a lot more impact than us telling them, he said. Teens spend 5 to 8 weeks in the intensive program and then are stepped down to a continuing care group that meets once a week for support, Welch said. Relapse isn't uncommon in the addiction and recovery world, but getting intervention as early as possible can help bring kids back to their pre-use selves, Ferguson said, and they learn a lot about themselves. Ferguson said the new program for adolescents and teens was identified as a community need in focus groups last year. The Prairie Center, which also provides substance use treatment, no longer provides an intensive outpatient therapy program for teens because of budget cuts, said its CEO, Gail Rainey. The Prairie Center also offers free assessments and treats about 100 adolescents and teens with substance use issues a year through one-on-one counseling, group sessions, and other services, said Laura Huth, the agency's Director of Development and Communications. There's no shortage of youths in the community who need substance use treatment help, she said. In a bit more ag news, Payette once again states best in beans. For the third straight year, Payette County farmers had the most productive soybean fields in the state, averaging 71.3 bushels per acre for the 2016 harvest, according to estimates released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Carroll County averaged 69 bushels per acre to rank second on the annual yield estimate report. Payette County was not able to hold onto the top spot in average corn yields after finishing at the top in 2015. Corn yields were a solid 218.7 bushels per acre and 10th in the state, but well below several other central Illinois counties, with Tazewell leading the way at 236. The corn had some early cool, wet conditions during planting and emerging. The soybeans were planted and had good weather, with a late August-September rain to help it finish, said Scott Dougherty, general manager of Top Flight Grain Cooperative in Monticello. News about Academy High, corporate center site to be school's temporary home. Headmaster, layout allows for flexibility. 4 months after Champaign's oldest high school settled on where it will be rebuilt, the city's newest high school has found a home. For the time being, Academy High, set to debut this fall with an enrollment of about 40, will be located at 2302 Fox Drive in the Fox Development Corporate Center in Champaign. The long-term hope is to build a permanent high school after leasing space for a few years. But for now, officials say the 9,450-square-foot space is a good fit based on its central location for residents in Champaign, Urbana, and Savoy, and its proximity to the University of Illinois and its research park. Headmaster Darren Paskovich said the building's open layout will give teachers and administrators flexibility in adjusting the learning environment throughout the day, allowing for several types of instruction, large and small group, individual tutoring, and group sessions. The move will begin this month with open house information sessions set for June. Annual tuition for the private secular high school is $15,800, but financial aid opportunities will be available, Paskovich said. In the area update, driver who hit GCMS bus ticketed, nobody injured. No one was injured when a Gibson City Melvin Sibley school bus carrying five children was struck Tuesday morning by an SUV about 4 miles north of Gibson City. Ford County Sheriff Mark Doran said the accident occurred around 7:09 a.m. on Illinois 47 near Ford County Road 1050 North. Responding were the Ford County Sheriff's Office, Gibson City Police Department, Gibson Area Ambulance Service, and Sullivan Township Fire Protection District. Upon arrival of first responders, it was determined that there were no injuries, Doran said. The Sheriff's Office, which investigated the crash, determined that the accident occurred as a 2005 Chevrolet Carryall, driven by Anthony L. Kern, 19, of Woodridge, was headed north on Illinois 47, directly behind the northbound bus, Doran said. Kern tried to pass, Doran said, but did not allow enough space to safely complete it. Kern swerved into the bus to avoid a head-on collision with a southbound vehicle, Doran said. Kern's vehicle then went into a roadside ditch next to the southbound lane as the bus pulled over onto the northbound shoulder of the highway. The bus was carrying five children. Paramedics from Gibson Area Ambulance Service evaluated all people involved in the crash and determined there were no injuries, Doran said. Kern was ticketed for the crash, Doran said. Both vehicles were able to be driven from the scene. Here's a tidbit from Today in History. On March 1st in 1932, Charles A. Lindbergh Jr., the 20-month-old son of Charles and Ann Lindbergh, was kidnapped from the family home near Hopewell, New Jersey. Remains identified as those of the child were found the following May. And on March 1st in 1957, The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss was released by Random House. I can't tell you how many times I read that to my younger brother. We're coming to the end of our first half hour. Let's take just a short break now, and then I will return with the second half hour of the News Gazette for Wednesday, March 1st, 2017. Please stay tuned.